The program originally scheduled to be heard at this time will not be presented. We bring you now in its place, ladies and gentlemen, a broadcast from London, England, from which point you will hear Alastair Cook, noted English correspondent and commentator, who will give you the latest news concerning the current situation in London. We take you now to London, England.
Hello, America. This is London calling. Here once again is Alastair Cook, bringing you the latest news today of the constitutional crisis. Since 2 weeks today, the fatal November the 25th, when the King first asked the Premier for legislation, this has been the most furious for the activity of the ministers and officials who almost certainly by now must know the King's decision. And it has been the most tranquil day in the newspapers and the streets. Here is more or less first a complete diary of today. At 9 o'clock this morning, Sir Godfrey Thomas, the Assistant Private Secretary to the King, and Mr. Monckton, the Attorney General to the Duchy of Cornwall, left Fort Belvedere by car. At 10 o'clock, Sir John Simon, the Home Secretary, arrived at Downing Street for a conversation with Mr. Baldwin before the meeting of the Cabinet. Sir John Simon is an expert constitutional lawyer and in all probability drafted Mr. Baldwin's statement the other day to the House. Mr. Monckton was then at 10 o'clock in the morning present at the conversation. At 11 o'clock this morning, the Cabinet met. At 11:12, Mr. Monckton and Sir Edward Peacock, the Receiver General to the Duchy of Cornwall, left No. 10 by car and went to Buckingham Palace. There they had a short consultation with members of the King's staff, Major Alexander, Keeper of the Privy Purse, and Major Hardinge, the King's Private Secretary. At noon, Mr. Monckton and Sir Edward Peacock returned to No. 10. At 1:15 p.m., the Cabinet meeting ended. At 1:52, Sir Edward Peacock and Mr. Monckton left Downing Street together in a royal car. At 2:20, Sir John Simon and Mr. Malcolm MacDonald, the Dominion Secretary, left No. 10 and walked across to the Dominion's office. Sir John left Mr. MacDonald there and drove away. And at 2:30 this afternoon, out into one of the rawest days that we've had this year, Mr. Baldwin went off for the House of Commons to make a statement which we all hoped and thought might be decisive, but which was merely to say that tomorrow he would make that statement. At 4:05, the Duke of York went off to Fort Belvedere to join the King, and immediately after he arrived, the Duke of Kent, who had spent the night at the fort, drove back to London. Late this afternoon, Mr. Monckton and Sir Edward Peacock called again at No. 10. Shortly afterwards, a motorbike bicycle dispatch rider, several of whom have been lately dashing along the roads near Belvedere, was sent for from Wellington Barracks. He went to No. 10 Downing Street, waited there about 15 minutes, and came out later with a dispatch case, and then rode off for Fort Belvedere. At Belvedere this morning, the King walked in the grounds in the cold, damp air, and paid a visit to his kennels to take a look at a Labrador retriever, which received a serious injury to his leg a few days ago. The King didn't like the look of it and sent for a veterinary surgeon, who stayed at the fort for several hours. Meanwhile, in Cairo, Mrs. Simpson spent a more normal day. She went out shopping last night, and this morning was visited for a long discussion by Mr. Goddard, her divorce solicitor. Lord Brownlow, who has agreed to see the press twice a day today, came out with this statement on Mrs. Simpson's behalf. Lord Brownlow said, "Mrs. Simpson has signed no document whatsoever. Mr. Goddard's visit, as he stated last night, was purely for the purpose of discussing Mrs. Simpson's business affairs in London." Dr. Kirkwood's presence in the airplane was due to the fact that Mr. Goddard had been advised not to fly or make any undue effort without his medical attendant. Dr. Kirkwood left for Marseilles early this morning and has not visited the villa at all. Late this afternoon, Mrs. Simpson's car, with almost certainly Mrs. Simpson in it, left in the direction of Monte Carlo. And tonight, Mr. Walter Monckton again arrived for a long discussion with the King at Fort Belvedere. Well, once more, the chief significance of these movements, the token that keeps the newspaper men firm in their belief that the King has days ago decided to abdicate, is the constant activity, the prolonged discussions between the treasury officials of the Duchy of Cornwall and the keepers of the King's purse. From this point of view, the most remarkable meeting today was that at 11:15 this morning between Mr. Monckton, the Attorney General for the Duchy of Cornwall, and Sir Edward Peacock, the Receiver General to the Duchy. Those two on one side, and on the other side, Major Alexander, who is the keeper of the King's Privy Purse, and Major Hardinge, the King's first private secretary. Now, if the King had made up his mind, he would presumably have asked his brother, the heir apparent, the Duke of York, for permission to remain Duke of Cornwall. As such, if he chooses to live in exile, he may draw a large income from mines, fisheries, and court fines in the Duchy of Cornwall. But many of these revenues, though primarily belonging to the Duke of Cornwall, belong to him only in his hereditary position as Prince of Wales. When there is no Prince of Wales, the Duchy passes automatically, as it did this time, to the King. Now, to separate out the legitimate revenues of the King and the permissible revenues of a new and, for the first time, independent Duke of Cornwall would be for anybody a laborious and tremendous job. If that job were being tackled now, there would be a quartet of personal officers to whom it would inevitably fall. And those four would be the four men who met and went into conference at the palace today. Namely, Mr. Monckton, the Attorney General for the Duchy, Sir Edward Peacock, the Receiver General, and Major Alexander, who keeps the King's private purse, and Major Hardinge, the King's secretary. These seem to me to be the main movements of the day and the maximum implications that, to one observer at any rate, can be drawn from them. In the House of Commons this afternoon, Mr. Baldwin appeared looking grey and lined and tired. As he faced a house less tense and smaller than 2 days ago, but not less quiet, Mr. Attlee, the leader of the opposition, led off with the formal question. Mr. Attlee, may I ask the Prime Minister whether he is in a position to add anything to the statement which he made to the House on Monday? Mr. Baldwin, I regret I am not in a position to add anything today, but I hope to make a statement tomorrow. Mr. Attlee, may I ask him whether he can give us a good hope in the statement tomorrow that he will realize the anxiety which is continually increasing so long as this matter is not dealt with? Mr. Baldwin, I can assure the Right Honourable Gentleman and the House that no one realizes that more than I do. Mr. Bellinger, a socialist member for Bassetlaw, then on his own account, stood up and said, may I ask the Prime Minister? At this point, there was a great wave of surprise and doubt and pain that went over the House, because this was a very official and rather grave motion that was being put quite formally by the opposition leader. Mr. Bellinger, the socialist from Bassetlaw, asked, may I ask the Prime Minister whether he is aware that grave financial inconvenience is being caused to many subjects in this country by the delay in coming to a decision? And will the Prime Minister kindly suggest to His Majesty? At this there were loud cries of, oh, and a most unparliamentary form of expression. And will the Prime Minister kindly suggest to His Majesty the necessity of coming to an early decision? Mr. Baldwin replied with great calm and dignity, I can assure him that that has not escaped me. Well, the newspapers today have slackened the tension of everybody's nerves. Most of the evening papers give up the wearisome pretense that any new advice can be offered, any new scruples or loyalties championed. David Lowe's audacious cartoon this morning of himself padlocked in a steam chamber while Colonel Blimp says, Gad, sir, and you shan't come out until you promise not to do a cartoon on the crisis. This gesture was so brash that it practically marked the end of the crisis, at least for journalists. Old Moore has been on the streets today. For Americans who do not know this British institution as regular and inevitable as roast mutton, let me say that every year on the streets of London and the provinces there is sold by poor hawkers a white packed booklet with no sort of attempt at format or layout. It is called Foolsham's Original Old Moore's Almanac, originally known as Dr. Francis Moore's Almanac, prophetic hieroglyphic engravings. Most of its 60-odd pages are crowded with a woeful recital of every kind of cure for every kind of backache, leg pain, ulcer, kidney trouble, pills, catarrh, indigestion, and eye ointment. But the middle few pages continue the prophetic service to the British public, which was started annually in 1697, the year when William III first threatened abdication. Old Moore for December of this year, in last year's edition, prophesied heavy snowstorms and embarrassment for the church. Well, there has certainly been about half an inch of snow so far, and the embarrassment of the church started only last Tuesday. But this year, Old Moore is more optimistic. The coronation, he thinks, will be held as arranged, and he sees the possibility of forming an empire parliament. This is what one gathers from a passage in Old Moore's Almanac for 1937. Coronation celebrations will be at their highest when May dawns, and unbounded enthusiasm everywhere, and among all classes, will evidence the immense popularity of King Edward VIII. It is possible, too, that after happenings may add to the rejoicings, the Almanac says. A meeting of Dominion statesmen seems likely, and something like an Empire Parliament may result. Cabinet changes and resignations, he predicts, in January and November, while the government seems to have strong opposition to face. Other predictions for the year include better bowl treatment, new taxes on luxury articles, increased old age pensions, helpful agricultural schemes, a modification of existing treaties to benefit Germany, heavy outlay on home defense measures, better conditions in India, the launching of a worldwide peace movement, and a general return to prosperity. In fact, it's a very good year for Old Moore. Well, when these items begin to appear naturally on the newspapers of a metropolis that has most to suffer from the possible surrender of the throne, it is no wonder that the headline news of the evening is not about the king, but about an air crash at Croydon with 14 dead in a gutted machine, and about the 8,500 Italian volunteers who have been drafted to help Franco win Spain for fascism. But at a time when this overwhelming domestic issue has been wearing like a file on everybody's nerves, it has been left to the young David Lowe and the ancient Old Moore to bring an injection of delayed humor. These two irreverents, the one, both of them, with beards, have shown that however tragic the outcome for a constitutional entity, nothing can prevent a city of 7 million people from remaining human beings. Good night.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. The National Broadcasting Company returns you to New York.
Back in America, ladies and gentlemen. You have just heard a broadcast from London, England, from which point you have heard Alastair Cook, noted English correspondent and commentator, who has given you the latest news concerning the current situation in London.
The National Broadcasting Company has once again this morning opened its network several hours earlier than usual in its role as a public servant. The National Broadcasting Company and its associates are only too happy to place at the disposal of its listeners the vast facilities which this modern era have produced to assure complete and accurate coverage of events of sufficient national and international interest. For several days now, developments in England have commanded the interest of the American people. Reports from reliable sources last night indicated that some decision might be forthcoming this morning from London. With the cooperation of the Press Radio Bureau and our representatives in London, the National Broadcasting Company will present frequent reports of the latest developments just as soon as they occur. At 6:05 this morning, Alastair Cook, well-known commentator, will speak to you from London and relay to us the latest information on the situation. In the meantime, for this 4 minutes before 6:05 o'clock, we present Pomp and Circumstance, the march played for us on the electric organ by George Crook, NBC organist. ¶¶
National Broadcasting Company presents a bulletin from the Press Radio Bureau.
London. Here's the program for what may prove to be one of the most momentous days in the history of the British Empire. At 6 o'clock Eastern Time, in the ballroom will form a cabinet meeting of the King's decision, and the executive committee men of the Labour Party will receive a confidential report of the King's important choice. The throne or Richardson at 9 o'clock our time. 45 minutes later, at 9:45, the House of Commons will know definitely the King's chosen fate. This bulletin is from the First Lady of Europe.
National Broadcasting Company presents another special broadcast from London. Alistair Cook, well-known commentator, speaking from London, will bring us the very latest developments in the London situation. Ladies and gentlemen, we take you now to London, England.
Hello, America. This is London calling. Here once again is Alistair Cook to give you the latest news from London.
It's cold in London this morning and damp as a clam. One of those raw, dank, misty mornings that possibly nobody listening to me at this time knows about, except possibly San Francisco. Overnight, one minor mystery and an object of fanciful speculation has been cleared. The airplane which flew most of the way to Cannes yesterday was going to Mrs. Simpson on the innocuous business of disposing of her London home. Dr. Kirkwood turns out to be not Mrs. Simpson's doctor, but Mr. Goddard's, the solicitor who has never flown before, and is ill, and requested that his medical advisor should be along with him. Overnight, the situation has stayed in the present tense sort of lull. Yesterday's relief was not a permanent one, but only a breathing period. There is now again so much activity, so much meeting and exchanging and coming and going of ministers, that we are again doubtful whether the King's decision will be announced this afternoon in the House of Commons, or whether the Prime Minister's statement will be only another truce with public anxiety. The Duke of Kent stayed all night at Fort Belvedere. So did Mr. Walter Monckton, the Attorney General of the Duchy of Cornwall, who would automatically take care of the King's livings and revenues if he abdicates. Mr. Baldwin, who spent 5 hours with the King last night, returned at 1 a.m. this morning and met Sir John Simon, to whom he talked for three quarters of an hour. Mr. Baldwin will report the result of his meeting to the cabinet, which is meeting at this moment. The Prime Minister's audience of the King was the sixth within recent days. In the newspapers, the anxiety is still there, but it's now like an old wound that you don't do anything about. The News Chronicle, for instance, has broken for the first time away from any editorial comment at all. And its leading editorial this morning reminds us from the other world across the channel of Spain's agony. The Daily Express has a tiny editorial asking a question, answering it, and championing Mrs. Simpson. This is what the London Daily Express says. Beau geste. Can we rejoice? Yes, we can rejoice. The crisis has passed into history, and the King is still with us. No question of the crown overriding the cabinet has ever arisen, nor have the ministers imposed surrender upon the King on a highly personal issue. Certainly there was disagreement that might have led to the departure of either King or ministers. The deadlock has been broken by an act of renunciation by a woman. Let us say this of Mrs. Simpson. Her name has been thrown about by gossips in some parts of the world for a long time, and in our part, for long enough. By her word, printed yesterday, she answers the whole pack of them. The Times this morning still keeps up its double-column news spread on the news page and has an editorial entitled A Lull. It says, this is the Times of London, the events of Monday have definitely relaxed the public tension. Not because Mrs. Simpson issued a dramatic offer. This, of course, runs directly counter to the editorial in the Express I've just read. Not because, says the Times, not because Mrs. Simpson issued a dramatic offer late that night at Cannes, but because the issues at stake had for the first time been set out beyond all risk of misunderstanding in this country. It is a little surprising, indeed, that so much importance should be attached to the published offer to withdraw from a situation which has been rendered both unhappy and untenable. For it is plainly prefaced by the announcement that this represents an unchanged attitude, as indeed had been commonly supposed. Times does not say by whom it had been commonly supposed. The decision of the future rests, it goes on, as it has always done, with the King himself, who would be the first to recognize that the burden is his alone, and who needs no assurance of the depth of loyal sympathy with which all his subjects await the outcome. Nor is there any further room, since the Prime Minister's two plain statements to the House of Commons, for the false and malignant insinuation that His Majesty is being hustled by his ministers, or that they have been interfering for their own purpose in his private affairs. The situation is far too grave for this sort of politics, and the House of Commons, which never fails to respond to a real crisis, has shown unmistakably what it thinks of them. The facts set out by Mr. Baldwin are worth recalling in this interval, because it is clear that they must have been stated with the King's full approval, and are therefore the final answer to the charge that there has been any breach between His Majesty and his ministers. A statement on Monday afternoon gave the first authoritative account of what had passed between the King and his ministers. With one notable exception, all the conversations have been, quote, strictly personal and informal, unquote. That is to say, conducted under conditions permitting His Majesty to seek counsel in complete frankness and confidence from an older man of great public experience. In these circumstances, several weeks ago, the King informed Mr. Baldwin of his desire to marry Mrs. Simpson whenever she should be free, and so on. And that just recounts again the events that led up to Mr. Baldwin's statement. The Times goes on. In the week that has since elapsed, the Cabinet has had no occasion to act. The King was known to be debating an issue of the deepest and most poignant moment. But short of interference, his ministers could give him no more than sympathy. The decision was, and is still, for him alone. No proposal of the Cabinet is before him, and therefore there is no possibility of their exercising pressure. He has proposed a certain course of action, and has been advised in constitutional form that it is impracticable. There is no reason to doubt that he has accepted the advice. In extreme cases where the sovereign doubts the authority of public opinion behind his ministers and his parliaments, the Constitution provides him with a means of appeal.
But this is clearly not such a case, says the Times, and there is no indication that His Majesty supposes it to be so. The plan of a morganatic marriage is therefore abandoned, and what the king has been considering is whether he shall take any other action. To take none is to acquiesce in the failure of what is known to be his heart's desire. But no positive action has been suggested, except one from which the whole empire shrinks. To urge the second alternative by direct or by indirect persuasion is a course that no constitutional cabinet could have any excuse for taking, and it has not been taken. All that ministers can do is to answer such questions as the king may put in person or through his appointed agents, in order that he may have the fullest possible understanding of the nature and consequences of any action he may choose to take. No doubt it is deeply distressing to the members of the cabinet, as it is to all the king's subjects, that they can do no more than this to help him at so painful a time. But in fact, they can only wait while he debates in his own conscience an issue of which they became aware less than a fortnight ago, but which he himself must have foreseen for a very much longer period. That's the end of the Times editorial this morning. The cabinet meeting continues at 10 Downing Street. Presumably the Prime Minister is giving to the cabinet the report of his five-hour conversation with the King last night. There is no further news at all from London, except that all the Demesne's prime ministers are standing by and have made arrangements to act immediately there is any report of the King's decision from London. The Prime Minister will address the House this afternoon, and London is still in this hopeless sort of tense lull, still waiting to know if Mr. Baldwin brought back from Fort Belvedere last night a final decision. I shall be back again at 1 o'clock. That's 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, to give a more comprehensive survey and summary of the London press. Good morning to you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. The National Broadcasting Company returns you to New York.